Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Relations between America's police forces and the publics they serve are seemingly the lowest they've ever been, with a spate of controversial police shootings and increasingly a reprehensible series of attacks on police, including a shooting just last night of two San Diego police officers. What can be done to repair this breach between the police and the public? My guest says nothing less than a complete overhaul of policing tactics and training. Norm Stamper was a 34-year veteran cop of the San Diego Police Department and later chief of police of the Seattle Police Department. That overhaul goes beyond the concept of community policing to what he calls a community-based police department and calls for citizen participation in all aspects of police operations, policymaking, program development, crime fighting and service delivery, entry-level and ongoing education and training for police officers, oversight of police conduct, and joint community police crisis management. He outlines his ideas and offers a thorough critique of our current policing tactics and policies in his book, To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Norm Stamper, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Your book, To Protect and Serve, was written prior to the shootings in Baton Rouge and Minneapolis and the subsequent targeting of and murder of police in Dallas and Baton Rouge. But those tragic events only point out the need for more change in how we police and how the public and the police interact. Your book has a lot of different topics on the way policing has to change in America. But what would you say the first step in improving police-public interactions would be?
Yeah, I think the first step is what I guess we could call an attitude adjustment. Police officers have been taught, this is a systemic issue, it's not, for me, a function of individual police misfeasance or malfeasance or what have you when things go wrong, although certainly individuals must be held accountable. It really is about the system, and any kind of a system that sets itself apart, in this case, a very delicate, demanding, oftentimes dangerous job, when the practitioners set themselves apart from the communities that they've been hired to serve, that pretty much guarantees misunderstanding, confusion, resentment, and the like. And so I come from the perspective that the police in America belong to the people, not the other way around, and that many police officers, because of the way they are raised in the system, acculturated by the system, take the attitude that we're the cops and you're not. And that certainly can come across, oftentimes does, as arrogant and giving a sense of superiority and so forth in relations with the community. So I think police need to change the, not so much the method of hiring. I think that's been pretty much reformed over the last 20, 30 years, actually. But the introduction of new police officers into the culture, the education, the training, and by far even more important than that, the informal welcome that police officers get.
What needs to be changed most, the formal training prior to becoming a police officer or that informal training that they actually get on the street once they are a commissioned police officer?
Oh, it's the latter for sure, Rich. If you think about any kind of an occupation, you're going to go through formal training typically at the onset, so-called threshold training, police academy training, and you're probably going to get a pretty good diet of professionalism. This is the way we do business in this city, so on and so forth. Then you get into the real world, and the education that takes place in the locker room or in the front seat of a police car is by far more captivating. I speak from personal experience. More interesting, and certainly from the point of view of new officers, more relevant, because you're actually now doing the work in the presence of senior officers who are very much inclined to say, forget that nonsense they taught you in the academy. You're in the real world now, and this is the way it's done.
You actually write in the book, you know, you started out as a pretty aggressive police officer yourself. When did that begin to change for you? Was there a moment or incident that sort of made you think twice about your approach towards the public?
Yeah, there certainly was. I should tell you that when I became a cop, it was almost by accident. A friend of mine was taking the civil service test, wanted to know if I'd accompany him. I said, sure. And I was just going to park myself under a eucalyptus tree in Balboa Park in San Diego. And this was 1965. And at the time, you could take the test, and if you passed it, be given an application package. So I thought, well, rather than just waiting outside for my pal, I would take the test. And I did, and I passed, and became a cop. And I remember looking at myself in a full-length mirror, and my wife and I had a small apartment in a city just south of San Diego, thinking, what have I done? I mean, this is crazy. If I had attitudes or feelings about the police, they were generally not positive ones because of experiences that I had had, some, of course, brought on by yours truly. But I thought, well, you know, it's starting to grow on me, this notion of being a police officer. I'll be a good cop. I won't use the N-word. I won't write bad tickets. I'll treat people with dignity and respect. And I was pretty full of myself. I'm gonna be a good cop. And about 5 minutes later, those good intentions pretty much evaporated in the face of the culture, the strength of the culture. I found myself in the company of magnetic personalities, very strong individuals, all possessed of what I thought was an acutely refined sense of humor, and so on and so forth. And within a very, a breathtakingly short period of time, I'm saying and doing things that I'd never done before in my life. So for about the first 14 months on the job, I was abusing the people I had been hired to serve. And my catalytic event was comeuppance at the hands of a principal prosecutor. This is a guy standing in the corridor outside of presiding in at the San Diego County Courthouse, and I had arrested a young man, 19 years of age, for being drunk in a public place and unable to care for himself or the safety of others, which met the standard. Problem was, he didn't really meet the standard at all. He was not drunk, but he presented with attitude, let's just say that. And I went up to the prosecutor. I'd seen how my senior officer did this, and I thought, no problem. I'll just sidle up to this guy and tell him he probably wants to dismiss the case, which I did. And he said, why? And I told him that it was kind of a skinny arrest. And he said, what do you mean by that? And I explained. And I said, he called me a pig. And he said, at the end of a very short conversation, Officer Stamper, does the Constitution of the United States mean anything to you? And I got to tell you, I was enraged. The nerve of this guy in his pinstripe suit and his slick back Hollywood hairstyle and his tortoiseshell glasses and the comfortable confines of the courthouse, while I'm out in the real world, in the mean streets being spat upon and having to fight individuals from time to time and, and braving the elements. This, of course, was San Diego. But I thought he had quite a nerve to call me on this arrest. The anger lasted about 30 seconds. It was replaced by embarrassment. As I've written elsewhere, by the time I slithered down the stairs of the courthouse out into a bright, sunshiny San Diego day, I was awash in shame. And I will never, of course, forget that moment or him and what he did for me. It was actually a frightening experience. I don't know how better to put it, but for me, I came to learn that behind all anger is fear. And if you dig deep enough, you'll find the fear. And the fear for me was that he had just attacked my new identity, this hard-charging, constitution-abusing, pleasure-seeking police officer who was violating the rights of the people that he had been hired to protect and serve. So he was attacking my identity, and he did me probably the biggest favor of my life.
My guest today is Norm Stamper, a retired 34-year veteran police officer. He was a former chief of police of Seattle, Washington, and the author of To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Now, you begin this book with Ferguson, with the Justice Department report on how Ferguson's police and their court system worked. And you also give us the way Officer Darren Wilson did confront Michael Brown, an alternative way, in which both parties could have come away unharmed, because even though Officer Wilson was not held liable and was not prosecuted, both parties in this incident were harmed.
Sure, and in fact, I've never spoken to a police officer who's taken a life who hasn't been harmed in some fashion, in some cases profoundly. So it's a cliche, but in any kind of a shooting, a police shooting, there are always two victims, the one who's left dead, in the case of Michael Brown, and the officer who survives, but never to realize his dream of being a police officer for his adult life. I do start the book with a story of how it might have been. And in the case of Darren Wilson and Michael Brown, in the case of Michael Slager and Walter Scott in North Charleston, South Carolina, Timothy Lohman and Tamir Rice in Cleveland, Jason Van Dyke and Laquan McDonald in Chicago, and other controversial police shootings, I draw the conclusion that had the police behaved differently, had they behaved sensibly, they would still be alive today, as they are, and so would those young African-American men they killed. And if we're ever to achieve a mutually respectful, more satisfying relationship and elevate officer safety in the process and officer morale in the process, I think we have to come to grips with the racism that is prevalent in American law enforcement. And I think we probably should ask ourselves if it's prevalent in our society, and I certainly see the evidence of that, why would it not be prevalent in policing? Unless we systematically disassemble it, disassemble the foundation of racism and construct in its place a mutually trusting relationship. In police work, there will always be situations that turn out tragically. It is simply in the nature of policing in our free and democratic society that police officers will have to make judgments that could leave somebody dead or in jail or in prison for the rest of their lives. And we can't ask officers not to do that delicate and demanding and sometimes quite dangerous work without providing them the support they need, the education, the training, the equipment, and frankly, the supervision of policing that I think is pretty desperately lacking in American law enforcement.
Now, you examined the Justice Department report on Ferguson's police and their court system, and one of the first conclusions you say that damaged this relationship between the public and the police was the fact that the police was being used as a revenue-producing entity. The quotas, tickets, and fines to fund government. How does this erode police trust and the police attitudes towards the people they serve?
Well, another name for this practice is policing for profit. And that's essentially what's happening when you install a system of quotas to direct, or in the case of Ferguson Police Department, to actually govern day-to-day police practices. You're setting up a mechanism that causes officers to hunt for activity, which they will translate erroneously into productivity. A productive cop is a cop who knows what the minimum numerical standards are, that's called a quota system, and meets or exceeds those standards. I grew up under precisely that kind of system. It didn't take me but 5 or 10 minutes to learn that the cops that were going to detectives, the cops who were getting promoted, were the cops who were productive, by which I mean they harvested activity. At the end of every one of those statistics, of course, is a human being, a fellow citizen. And to get to those numbers that will yield what you want in terms of your career aspirations and so forth, you got to stop a lot of people. And it'd be nice if you had constitutional grounds for those stops, but in Ferguson and many cities across the country, that's just kind of a nicety. That is not a requirement. And so we wind up with police officers stopping and frisking, searching and seizing, arresting, and oftentimes resorting to force, including lethal force, unjustifiably. So when the police practice is being guided by a quota system, the community police relationship will suffer in the most fundamental way imaginable. And that was the case in Ferguson, from court system to the city manager to the city council, with very few voices raised in opposition to it. The police chief was made to understand, if he wasn't meeting his revenue standards. That's policing for profit in the way it's commonly referred to, and it's just plain wrong.
Now, nearly every police department in the country will say they don't do that, but how prevalent is it, do you think?
It's quite prevalent. It is not as bad as it was when I became a cop. I'm proud of the fact that, along with a number of other change agents within the San Diego Police Department, we pretty much put an end to the practice of quotas, replacing it with a form of true community policing, the idea being that police and community get together and establish an authentic partnership, and jointly they identify and analyze and sort of develop suggested remedies for, you know, the kinds of problems that affect quality of life in our neighborhoods. We had a really solid run of that kind of policing, which was helpful in all but extinguishing that. There's still some supervisors, tragically, who don't know how to superview the work that is being done without counting the numbers and developing an over-reliance on those numbers to evaluate, to judge the quality of police work. And I think that that is very common throughout the country.
Well, you mentioned the fact that this quota system sort of takes police and views their public as basically a commodity to consume in a way. And then the next section deals with the war on drugs, which also sort of erodes this sort of view of the public as being served as opposed to an enemy.
Sure. You know, I did become a cop in the mid-60s at a time of great civil unrest, at war demonstrations and campus unrest and civil rights insurrections. Police officers were taking rocks and bottles and occasionally Molotov cocktails and even occasionally sniper fire. So it was a tumultuous time. Nobody needs to be educated who was around during the 60s to understand the nature of that conflict between community and police. But coming out of the 60s and into the earliest part of the next decade, we were moving towards something resembling community policing. And I'm either blamed or credited as the architect of the country's first official community policing program in 1972. But also in the early 70s, as the police are trying to either make amends or atone or simply solve the problem of a strained community police relationship, Richard Nixon famously proclaimed drugs and drug abuse public enemy number one and declared all-out war on drugs, which was really an all-out declaration of war against his own people, and predominantly young people and poor people and people of color. So what we did in 1971 is begin the march toward increased militarization throughout the United States. You don't fight a war without enemies. You don't fight a war, for that matter, without propaganda. And we had plenty of that accompanying the drug war. So our frontline soldiers, our foot soldiers in the war on drugs, were the nation's cops. That structurally constituted an enormous strain in the relationship between especially white cops and young black men, to a somewhat lesser degree, young black women, and certainly Latinos, depending on the makeup of your particular city. And that relationship began deteriorating in a very rapid and sustained fashion. So the drug war gives rise to military equipment, military weaponry, military tactics, certainly in the form of those pre-dawn drug raids that oftentimes were precipitated by somebody's observing a young man walk into an apartment or a home with a baggie of marijuana, or walk out of said home with a small quantity of drugs. So we then move on it a day, 3 days, 2 or 3 weeks later after we've made a case, and then we go in. And we go in very much like an army, with flashbang grenades and semi-automatic weapons, and tragically, wrong houses have been hit. Innocent people have been struck. Innocent family pets have been killed. Police officers caught in crossfire have been killed. And what do we have to show for it? Well, tens of millions of our fellow Americans incarcerated, in some cases for very long periods of time, for nonviolent drug offenses. And then we wonder why we have only a single head of household in many African-American communities. If we want to really understand that, we've got to understand the dynamics of mass incarceration. I think we have done a terrible injustice to our police officers, but certainly to our communities, by waging war on them. And if we were to end the drug war, if we were to replace a completely bankrupt, unwinnable defense of prohibition, if we were to replace that prohibition with a regulatory model and rigorously enforce it, we would almost overnight see healthier neighborhoods, safer communities.
You do have a section on police militarism, and you know, I can recall one of these terribly tragic police shootings where in the aftermath of peaceful protests, the police have what looks to be a tank on hand. And there was a very interesting picture before the police shootings in Baton Rouge, which maybe points out sort of the police thinking, but there was a very famous picture that made the wires of a nonviolent protester being confronted by a police that was so decked out in body armor, shoulder pads, arm Kevlar. He looked like RoboCop.
I don't know if we're thinking about the same picture or photograph, Rich, but I was struck by the imagery of a young African-American woman, tall, statuesque, wearing
yes.
a gauzy dress, standing almost at attention directly in front of two or three of these RoboCop appearing officers. That was our Tiananmen Square moment, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of, you know, the iconography, if you think about police and protests in this country. Let me just offer one other image, and that is of a police officer sitting high atop an MRAP. That's a mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicle built for the wars in the Middle East. And it was trotted out, along with officers in full military garb, even as the protests in Ferguson were nonviolent. And so when you have an army advancing on young, unarmed people, the chances that hotheads within the crowd or others with maybe more deliberate political motives can instigate a real fight, a pitched battle between police and their fellow citizens. That should never happen. Under circumstances where it does, we really need to break it down and ask ourselves, what triggered it? What sustained it? What caused it to last for days and days? And in almost all cases, the overly aggressive, militarized response is determined to be the cause of the intensification of the tensions between police and community, and to reduce it really to a fight. And there are ways to prevent that. I'm not saying that there aren't occasions when it's unavoidable. And yeah. I will say this, I was present in the immediate aftermath of the so-called McDonald's massacre in 1984. I was an assistant chief in San Diego at the time. And one James Huberty, armed to the teeth, had gone into this fast food restaurant and started killing people. And he was literally murdering women and children and men. And the tableau was of carnage was just unbelievable. Little children lying in pools of their own blood, strawberry milkshakes, people at mid-bite. It was the kind of scene that you just, you know, you might see in a really bad movie. But it was horrific. And we asked ourselves, because part of that carnage took place when we had police officers in position, but who could not move closer because Mr. Huberty was training fire on them as well. We finally got a SWAT sharpshooter, our sniper, and put him in place, and he did, in fact, shoot and kill Huberty. But we asked ourselves after, had we had a military-grade armored personnel carrier, could we have driven that right up to the door, maybe even through the door, and taken him out earlier? And the answer was a unanimous yes. So there is a time, there is a place. Speaking of rampage violence, of mass murder, speaking of barricaded suspects who've taken hostages and are clearly armed and dangerous. What's needed there is the utmost in military discipline, military-like discipline and tactics and equipment, but not for these pre-dawn drug raids, not for the what I consider to be the complete mission creep of that SWAT mentality.
My guest today is former chief of police in Seattle, a 34-year police veteran, Norm Stamper. His book is To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. It's published by Nation Books. And in it, you go through a whole variety of areas where better training for officers dealing with mental illness, with members of the public with mental illness, as well as mental illness and traumatic stress within the force, a way to de-escalate confrontations, discipline for recognizing fear and managing fear. There's a whole range of things in the book, police accountability from what's the police's role, prosecutor's role, and the public's role. But at the end of the book, you actually have some recommendations that comes out of a presidential task force, but the very first is thinking that we need to federalize standards for police departments around the country.
Yeah, I do depart from the president's 21st century police task force, which I think did some extraordinary work. I there's not a recommendation that I have any significant disagreement with. It just doesn't go far enough. We are a nation that prizes home rule and states' rights, and that's a deep part of our history. But when you think about it, we have almost 18,000 law enforcement agencies, but only one constitution. And that constitution is binding on every single police officer and every single agency. And yet we continue to see systematic violations of our fellow Americans' constitutional rights. Search and seizure prominent among them, the Fourth Amendment, the right to assemble and express oneself, the First Amendment, and so on. But if we want to provide effective supervision and reasonable controls over police policies and practices, then we need to not nationalize our law enforcement agencies, but we need to, I would use the term, constitutionalize their practices by setting at the federal level standards for every aspect of what I will call procedural justice. Stop and frisk, search and seizure, laws of arrest, and seized and forfeited assets, and certainly use of force, including, obviously, lethal force. There are no unifying standards that will help us answer the question, what is good policing, anywhere in this country. And I think the federal government, certainly and absolutely, in conjunction with local agencies, community activists, rank-and-file police officers, police chiefs, civic officials, getting together for the very long and hard slog that would be associated with setting standards for police work in those procedural justice areas, because that gets to, you know, the secular Bible of the land. That Constitution is binding on every cop. So I'm saying certify police officers who achieve the standards, and their agencies, for that matter, and decertify those individual officers and agencies that won't play by the rules.
The name of the book is To Protect and Serve. Norm, thank you very much for joining us.
That's my pleasure, Rich. Thank you.
Norm Stamper, the former chief of police of the Seattle Police Department and a 34-year veteran cop, speaking with us yesterday. He's the author of To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police. It's published by Nation Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.